long overdue mailbag edition of the Dunked On Basketball podcast. I look back, the last time we did one was January 8th, which is clearly not often enough. We have a great queue of questions lined up, and joining me to go through them, Daniel LaRue.
Yeah, almost as long as how long we've waited between 15 and 60s.
Well, there's a lot of the trade deadline really kind of put a wrench in the gears a little bit for that sort of thing. But yeah, I'm really excited to do this mailbag. We got some good questions, and let's get started. I'll do the first one from Chengez Khan. Which team is currently in the worst position for long-term future success, i.e. lack of assets, poor ownership, antiquated front office, small market, etc.? You can exclude the Nets if it makes things more interesting, and we will exclude the Nets because it does. They are clearly in, well, maybe not clearly, because they do have some cap space that you can construct a way in which maybe they could get better over the next couple of years, but with the lack of draft assets and the lack of talent on the team, you'd have to say that they're in pretty ugly shape. I think the way to start with this, though, is to just kind of define what we're talking about by long-term future success. I mean, I think to me that means being a perennial playoff team at the minimum.
Sure. I think that's a good way to do it. And there are a lot of different factors. I think that the questioner did a nice job of saying some of them. So it's a lack of assets with the way ownership and the front office in general. I wouldn't necessarily say antiquated, though that is potentially a part of it because there are antiquated front offices that have done well. And market size is something that's important to me when I was thinking about this, because just as a practical matter, we see bigger markets not only get more consideration for max level players, which of course is an easy way into the playoff picture, but also they can get a lot more value from minimum guys, which can help push you from, let's say, the 10 range into the 6 range, and so that can be enough. So there are different ways to think about it. When we took out the Nets, I spent a little bit of time thinking about it because it actually got hard, and I kind of went into two camps. One is the ones that are in bigger markets but just have some question marks, and then smaller market teams that are a little bit more put together in terms of maybe a star talent but just have other flaws.
Well, the one asset that he did not include is cap space.
Right.
And in the current environment that we're in, with the cap spike going to be over $20 million very likely this year, could potentially even be as much as $20 million next year, there is probably more help or more hope for the league's downtrodden than there ever is. Even just if you want to just delude yourself into thinking that you can get a free agent, you have that ability. There aren't any teams right now where you look at like the Isaiah Thomas Knicks, for example, where they had traded away two picks, 2006 and 2007, for Eddie Curry. They gave up the number two pick, and then they had swap rights the next year that ended up being Joakim Noah. You don't have any teams like that now, because even Brooklyn can have cap space pretty easily. You know, and also contracts are shorter. You don't have like, all right, we just traded for, you know, Stephon Marbury, and he's his contract goes through like, you know, the next 5 years, and he's making $20 million a year with a lower cap. You don't have any of those situations. So I think that one thing that NBA teams and owners who are kind of lamenting, oh, this cap spike is really bad for the league, it's a perversion of the system, we wish it wasn't happening, you do provide more hope for these kind of downtrodden teams, and of course, more interest in the off season, which drives a lot of the interest in the league. But so who did you come up with as far as your teams that are kind of not in the greatest shape?
So there are kind of three that I had clustered, and all for very different reasons. Dallas, I think, has the least long-term talent on their team. They have guys that I like, but they're just, when you think about, you know, who even is under contract for this team for a couple of years, you have Barea, who I don't love on his deal, Justin Anderson, who isn't really getting into the rotation, though I still like him as a prospect, and that's about it. And
well, we can count the coach.
Yeah, Carlisle. Yeah.
Long-term talent.
Exactly.
And that's another one actually.
And their owner.
Haven't mentioned yet is coaching is obviously huge, and just the organization as a whole. I mean, that's why I agree with you on Dallas's actual talent that they have on the roster, but they also have plenty of flexibility. Dirk will still be there. He's still a pretty good player, despite some idiots like me proclaiming that this might be the year that he kind of, you know, couldn't really be the foundation any longer. So with Dirk and Carlisle, I think for the next couple of years, you're okay, but you're right. I think you have to wonder where the next kind of infusion of talent is coming from, if not free agency. And there are a ton of teams that have free agents. They've usually been able to get someone and maximize their signings and kind of stay competitive over the years. But if you want to look at a team that's really going to be a long-term playoff team, they got a lot of work to do, but I trust this organization way more than I trust some of these other ones that I'm sure that we will mention.
Right, and so that's why, to me, they were in consideration, but not – I didn't really mean that they were going to win, quote-unquote, this question, but they were them. And then the next team for me is a team that I actually just talked about a little bit with Jared Dubin, which is the New Orleans Pelicans. And they're a hard one in a similar way to a couple other teams where, yeah, there are a lot of flaws with them, you know, just the money that they have tied up in guys like Omer Asik, but they also have Anthony Davis. So
yeah, if they hadn't lucked into him in the 2012 lottery, they would be so burned right now. And the fact that they've been this bad, even with him on the team, is quite an indictment. You've got Mickey Loomis, a football guy, is kind of running things. Maybe Dell Demps, who knows how long he's going to be around. Tom Benson, not really a fantastic owner, who really hasn't done much other than come in with "you must make the playoff" proclamations. And then, although we were on board with this, fire the coach who got them there anyway. So, yeah, I think that there's been absolutely nothing that this organization has done. I mean, they even waived Jarnell Stokes, which was crazy to me. I thought he actually might – he's exactly the kind of guy that this team should be taking minimum flyers on. He's leading the D-League in PER. Like, why wouldn't you keep him on the team?
And he has a non-guaranteed contract for next year, so it was a riskless transaction.
Yeah, that was just – that was crazy that they – like, who are you bringing in other than the guy who is an analytics favorite, was one of the best players in the D-League? That's exactly who you should be bringing in for the rest of this year, especially a guy who just kind of fits with Anthony Davis. Anyway, I mean, we're getting far afield here. You know, Jarnell Stokes isn't going to make or break guys in these rankings. We hadn't talked about that, and it kind of aroused my ire. Yeah, so the Pels, and I would actually put the Knicks in a very similar category, other than the fact that they'll have more cap space.
And their cap space is more valuable.
Yeah, yeah, and they have Porzingis. I mean, and Porzingis isn't as good as AD. And Phil Jackson, I think, has actually, you know, done reasonably well. He's found some decent minimum guys. They just were starting from a really miserable point. And they also kind of have the albatross contract of Carmelo, which is going to get pretty ugly pretty soon. And, you know, he has the no trade clause. I mean, I do believe in the Knicks organization, frankly, more than the Pels, more than the Kings, more than the Lakers at this point, because I think they have done some good things. They have had some forward thinking, other than just, you know, being completely wedded to the triangle. That's sort of like the one thing that I think is a big problem for them.
Yeah, that's a problem.
And they don't.
And the whole situation of maxing out Melo, or close to maxing out Melo, and giving him a no trade clause, I always had issues with that. But for me, the grand champion, other than the Nets, and maybe even including them, is the Sacramento Kings.
Well, it's so weird, right? Because the Knicks with Porzingis, the Pels with AD, the Kings with DeMarcus Cousins. I mean, those are guys, AD and Cousins are probably top 10 players in the league, if not, you know, top 15. So to say that those teams are in the worst situation, but DeMarcus only has two more years under contract after this. They are not close to the playoffs. They have management, although there has at least been talk that they're going to hire kind of a more experienced GM with some more cap knowledge, but and they've had just massive dysfunction at all levels since Vivek took over. So I think ultimately, especially in this era where there's more flexibility than there's ever been, and there are more smart offices than there's ever been, if you're going to kind of bet on an organization to do poorly, we're talking about being a perennial playoff team. Well, they have Cousins right now, probably for two more years until he leaves, you would imagine, or they trade him. And they're not close to the playoffs right now either. So with that being the case, it's hard to see what their path is before they just have to go get bad and then try to get another star after Cousins, you know, unless they can trade him for something really good. But once he gets into the last year of his contract, they're not going to be able to trade him for anything. I mean, I think if I were them, I would be thinking about trading him seriously this summer. But I highly doubt that they're going to have the ability to do that.
Moving into a new building, there are a lot of concerns there. They also have draft pick obligations that are out there. They combine a couple of the really negative aspects. Their cap space is less valuable. Sacramento is not really a market that will woo guys. They also have less cap space than some other teams. And when you think about it in terms of management, one of the things that concerns me about them is just how little traction they've got, and I sent this to you in a G-Chat message a week ago, how little traction they've gotten out of their guys on minimum contracts. I mean, not to say that every guy on a minimum deal is going to be gangbusters or anything like that, but that, to me, shows a little bit of a problem because their minimum guys actually would be getting playing time.
Yeah, Seth Curry is still someone I think who could at least get a little bit more of a look. Caron Butler, I think, was mostly brought in as kind of a veteran leadership guy. Maybe they hoped they could play for him a little bit, or that he could play for them a little bit, but he obviously hasn't been able to. James Anderson has failed on successive minimum contracts in a ton of places as well. Yeah, and even Marco Bellinelli hasn't been that good. Kufos was always totally redundant once you had Cauley Stein and DeMarcus in there, although that's not a terrible contract. I think he'd be better in another location. So, yeah, I think the Kings would be up there. And let's go through the last candidate. I think the last candidate, unless you have any more, the Lakers, and then I guess we'll pick one ultimately.
I think as somebody who was born and raised in California and watched the Lakers just pull rabbits out of their hats, I said this in the AMA that I did, I just never feel like they're out of it. And I also think that D'Angelo Russell is an intriguing young player, and if they keep their pick this
year... How many years in a row will they have to keep failing before you feel like they are out of it?
If they don't get anybody by 2017, if they don't get, let's say, somebody in that stacked free agent class, then the paradigm shifts for me, and for a long time. Like, that basically, it's kind of like for me with a draft prospect, when I turn on somebody, I turn on them hard, because then what that'll say is that the assumption is invalid for now.
Yeah, I guess what you could say too is that they still have this amazing market. Theoretically, they're going to be able to get somebody. You know, 2014, 2015 didn't really have that star-studded of free agent classes. I think really this summer, if they don't get one of the top guys, which it seems very likely they won't, and then they also kind of blow their space for the long term because there's just too much pressure now, we have to get a little bit better, and then they could lose their draft pick this year. They got its top three protected. Then they still owe another pick to Orlando, too, in the future from the Dwight Howard trade. So if they kind of blow their cap space for the long term this summer, then I think, they could be in big trouble. And also, you know, I guess a lot of it depends. What do you think of Julius Randle, Jordan Clarkson, and D'Angelo Russell as a foundation? So what do you think of those guys?
I don't think any of them are going to be probably the best or maybe even the second best player on a really good team. But I like Russell. I think his ability to pass and run some pick and roll is encouraging. He's the guy that stands out the most to me. I don't see Jordan Clarkson as somebody who – I see him as a useful player, but not an essential player. So it'll be interesting.
Yeah, maybe more of like a good sixth man.
Right,
type,
and he's ultimately, with the Gilbert Arenas provision, he'll be paid less than that.
Yeah, we'll get to him. We actually have another question about him later.
Yeah, so there's that. But what I will say is I hope we can remember and do this exact question sometime around July 3rd, around the end of July. Because I think that we will have maybe not a different answer, but the teams under consideration might change substantially.
Yeah, I mean, we could do an entire podcast on this question of just who is the most hopeless. I ultimately think I'm going to go with the Kings. They don't have, other than Cauley Stein, they really don't have anyone on the roster on rookie contracts who's going to be any good. Cousins, I think, you know, unless they can really take a step forward next year and make the playoffs, maybe then you could say he'll stick around. They could always try to renegotiate and extend him too, although I don't think I would do that if I were him. And I think that it's going to get to the point pretty soon where it's going to behoove them to trade him. I would certainly be asking for a trade if I were him post-haste, given how dysfunctional the organization has been.
I don't think it's really affected his free agent value that much, but that could change. You know, if he gets to the point where, let's say, it's getting towards his last year under contract and his team has never won, even let's say, like, I think they'll win 30 this year, but like, let's say they've never won 30 games, that's going to be something that people talk about.
All right, what's next?
From Phil Gillette, also apologies if we mess up your name. That's just what happens. If you want us to get it right, just tell us how to say it. Do you see any potential holes in Karl Anthony Towns' game whatsoever? Where does he realistically rank at this point among all-time rookies from a player-to-build-a-team-around perspective?
Well, all right, I'll start with the first question. I think his biggest problem is a lack of explosiveness off of 2 feet. I think that if he really gets in the weight room, does a bunch of squats, a bunch of power cleans, really kind of works on that kinetic chain to explode off of 2 feet, I think he can get a lot better, you know, just get stronger to where he can really bully guys down into the post, get fouled a little bit more. But I think all that is very, very solvable. That's the sort of thing that can kind of, I think it's easier to increase. He's pretty explosive off of 1 foot. So that's kind of what's harder to improve from just a working out standpoint. Where does he rank at this point among all-time rookies from a player to build a team around perspective? I mean, are we saying just kind of how they looked at the time? Or are we saying rookies who eventually turned out to obviously be, you know, top tier Hall of Fame type of guys?
I mean, you can define it how you want, but
why don't we do it? Let's do it this way. Let's do it since the rookie scale came into being in 1995. That's a good way to do it, because now you have this system where you get guys on a contract for four cheap years, and then you get them as a restricted free agent. So you basically have whoever you want for 9 years. So let's look at, like, since 1995.
So LeBron, to me, is far and away number one. Like, I think that he, just the talent that he showed and what he could do, even at that age, I think he was at a different level. And off the top of, like, kind of, to me, the next guy, that at least that I think of, is Tim Duncan. And I have, maybe AD, you could go in either direction with those guys. What I love about Tim Duncan, and it's something that I like about Towns, too, is you can plug and play them. What he does well is very transferable, and that might, in a way, lower his ceiling in a way, but I think that makes it easier to build around them. But I would have him below Duncan, who was really polished, but was so crazy good then.
Yeah, I would say he's above Kobe.
Yeah, I would too.
For where, I mean, you remember Kobe in his first year, he was right out of high school. He was also pretty young as he came right out of high school, but he barely played his first year. His second year, he made the All-Star team, but, you know, he looked like he had a ton of potential, but he wasn't playing as well, especially as a two-way guy that year, as Towns is this year. He kind of made the All-Star team just because, you know, he looked really good. And really, Kobe's first great season wasn't until his fourth year when they made the finals. I would put him above Kobe, at least as of right now. Now, that doesn't mean that I am predicting that he will have a better career than Kobe Bryant. What I'm saying is just that at the time, I think he looks a little bit better right now at the same age as Bryant was. KG might be another guy that you could throw in there as well. Since we're saying 1995, that's when he was drafted.
What about Anthony Davis for you, if you had to compare those two?
Yeah, AD, I would say, oof. Yeah, I think Towns is having a better rookie year than AD did.
Yeah, and I think in terms of building around, like, the idea that he could be a rim protector and kind of be that defensive anchor, I mean, we haven't seen it as much as you want to. It's a little bit overhyped right now because he gets to play a lot, well, less now with Kevin Garnett, but he still has done a good job.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think he's someone who can be a real good defensive player. Obviously, AD certainly looked like that as well. I would say, actually, that AD's defense, given what his reputation was coming out of college, has actually been a little bit disappointing.
I would agree.
In the aggregate, maybe a part of that is due to coaching. And last year, I thought he had a really good defensive season, but he has not had a great defensive season other than last year. Anybody else that we're missing here?
Well, yeah, because there aren't real...
Chris Paul? How about Chris Paul?
I'd have Chris Paul over Towns. I loved him as a rookie.
Yeah, Chris Paul probably had the best season by a rookie point guard ever, and he was... Although he was... That year, he was a year older than Towns is right now. And then Paul kind of had an injury hit year, his second year, and then his third year, he had like a 30 PER and probably should have won the MVP.
Yep.
So, Paul would have to be, I would say Paul is probably a little bit better than Karl Towns as well. I don't expect Towns to have as good a year next year as Paul had as a rookie.
Would you have Duncan over Towns too?
Oh, yeah.
He was amazing.
Yeah, although, I mean, if you look at, and it's always hard to project guys versus college to the NBA, but if you look at what Karl Towns is doing now in the NBA versus Tim Duncan his sophomore year, I mean, his sophomore year at Wake Forest, he had like kind of emerged by the end of that year as being really, really good. But, you know, it was really kind of the end of that sophomore season that he really burst on the scene. So at a similar age, you might have to say that Towns is better. He's been really had a great season in the NBA. You know, he's putting up, you know, 28 and 14 in the NBA, which I don't know that Tim Duncan at that time could have done that. But, when you consider a guy in his rookie year, you know, I think you would put Paul above him. You would put Tim Duncan above him. I would say you might put AD a little bit below him, and of course, LeBron.
What about Durant? I'd say he'd...
I would put Durant below him. Durant's rookie year actually was not particularly successful. He wasn't put in a position to succeed by PJ Carlissimo playing the two in sort of that last year in Seattle. So that's another... I would say, no, I'd put Durant below. And then Durant obviously came on very, very quickly. But no, I'd say his rookie year is much better than Kevin Durant's rookie.
I would agree.
All right, that's probably a good enough one for that. And I'm sure someone could tweet at me if I forgot somebody since 1995 that we should be thinking of. All right, next one here from Brian Hradek, Hradek. Basically, he's asking thoughts on the Cavs a month after Blatt was fired. What do you got?
I think they look a little bit better, but I don't see a sea change personally. And the talk about pace is something that is a positive in many ways for them. But I don't, when I watch them, I don't think I'm seeing a substantially different team that's utilizing Kevin Love a lot better or anything like that.
Yeah, I think they're doing a little bit. We talked on last night's pod about how they've been running some more plays for him, whether it's pick and pops to the corner, whether they're actually running him off of screens a little bit, kind of like they did in Minnesota. I haven't really seen, like, oh, wow, this is a different team. You know, they've talked about playing with pace better. They did actually really push the ball on the fast break against Charlotte yesterday, but in the aggregate, they have been getting in their offense a little bit faster in the half court. But in the aggregate, I haven't been like, wow, these guys are totally, you know, it's not like going from Mark Jackson to Steve Kerr, we'll put it that way. And in Lou's defense, it's hard to do that during the
Absolutely.
Season when you have limited practice time.
And we'll see how they incorporate Channing Frye, which is, of course, a difference between a guy who just wasn't on the team when Blatt was there. But if they can use him well, that certainly helps.
Yeah, that's another thing. I mean, I think that having different personnel might be good, too. Any other thoughts that you had on the Cavs? I mean, we've hit on that just in the games that we've talked about with them, too. I haven't seen that much of a difference yet, and a lot of it, too, is just that Kyrie is coming back and playing a little bit better. But I do think they have gotten a little bit more out of Love. I wouldn't say by any means that it's looking like a mistake.
Oh, no, not at all. Okay, next question is for me from Austin Peters. Is Nate's skill set more back to the basket, old school big, or is he the type of pick and roll machine that modern NBA craves? And I actually, from when we've played together, I think your face-up game is better than your back to the basket game, but that's also because back to the basket in the settings that we've played is distinctly not fun. So I personally think that you're better face-up. What do you think?
Well, nobody really plays pick and roll and pick up.
Right.
And I will say this, like, when I was growing up, just playing in high school basketball in the Chicago area, we only played one team that really ran a pick and roll. It was Lyons Township, which is where Jeff Hornacek went to school. And so that was all we ever had to practice pick and roll defense was when we played against them. And really, it was all kind of motion offenses, you know, flex, just like Bobby Knight motion offense type of stuff. So really, yeah, the pick and roll was just not something that a lot of teams did back then, at least where I was going to college or when I was going to high school. And it really wasn't until, you know, you see now that's all teams do in AAU is pick and roll. So things have kind of changed a little bit, I would say, and being a great pick and roll point guard and a good pick and roll big man. So I never really, you know, I love to play pick and roll, but I'm probably just not as good at it just because I never had that formatively when I was growing up.
Makes sense.
Let's take a brief interlude here to talk to you about SeatGeek, the inaugural sponsor of the Dunked On Basketball podcast. Have you ever been frustrated trying to buy tickets online? Most sites make it really complicated, and they all try to sneak in these huge fees at checkout. That's why you need to try SeatGeek. They've made it easier than ever to buy and sell sports and concert tickets. It's an app that you can just download. Once you get all your information in, it's essentially two swipes to do it. You don't have to worry about CAPTCHA, and they aggregate all of the tickets together from various sites. You don't have to worry that, oh, I've missed out on this deal. I got to check 8 million more sites to make sure I'm not getting burned here by paying too much. And the other thing you can do on SeatGeek is you can sell your tickets there, and they have a tool that both will tell you how much you should buy tickets for and how much you should sell them for, and you can make sure that you're pricing your tickets accurately and that you're getting a decent deal on tickets. It really is a winner for both buyers and sellers. Anything that kind of brings guys together in an economic way like SeatGeek is a fantastic way to buy tickets. And of course, don't forget that if you are using SeatGeek for the first time, my listeners can get a $20 rebate off of their first SeatGeek purchase. You download that free SeatGeek app, go into the settings tab, click add a promo code, and that promo code is, of course, CapSpace. That's what it is for all the sponsors, all one word, and SeatGeek will send you $20 after you've made your first SeatGeek purchase using that CapSpace code. This one is from Daniel DeYoung. How far back in time would you have to travel for a 2016 league average player, let's say Lavoie Allen, to be an MVP candidate?
I talked about this a little bit with Jim Barnett when he was on Real GM Radio, and his stance on this, having played against Wilt Chamberlain and many of the guys of that era, was that the best players would compete in any era. And so if we're talking MVP candidates, I think that would be a little bit tougher, especially for a big man. But, you know, to be a useful starter, I think that you wouldn't have to go back super far.
Yeah, Lavoie Allen, to me, was an interesting pick because he's just not a guy who has a ton of skill level scoring. And so, you know, I think Lavoie Allen could have been like Wes Unseld or something, you know, maybe kind of like along those lines. And Wes Unseld did win an MVP in his rookie year, which is probably one of the more ridiculous MVPs ever. But so 1955-56 is when they first came out with the MVP award, and Bob Pettit won it that year. Then it was Bob Cousy, Bill Russell, Bob Pettit, Wilt Chamberlain, Oscar Robertson, Bill Russell, Wilt Chamberlain, So those guys, LaVoy Allen wouldn't be as good as any of those guys. But if you took, say, you know, J.R. Smith or someone, or like Lou Williams, someone who is kind of average but is like a really good scorer and has more perimeter athleticism, I think that's what one of the bigger differences is, that if you had a guy who just had modern athleticism and ability to put the ball on the floor in ways that, you know, weren't really conceived of back then, I think that kind of type of person could win MVP, you know. But I think a big guy who's just sort of like a plugger, like Allen, a rebounder, you know, I don't think that he would get in there. I think maybe if you went back to like the George Mikan era, you know, maybe the early 50s, then someone like LaVoy Allen, he'd probably be better than like George Mikan. But once you get into like guys like Pettit, Cousy, guys who really had like a skill level, Bill Russell, who certainly had the athleticism for the modern game, then I think that, you know, an average player, unless he was just some really good perimeter player. I mean, maybe you could look at someone who is just sort of a league average point guard, could have been MVP back then. I mean, he probably would have run circles around someone like Cousy. So yeah, maybe I think it would have to be a perimeter player, though, kind of an average perimeter player rather than an average big guy.
You made me think about J.R. Smith in an era that didn't have a three-point line, and it hurt my heart.
Yeah, but J.R., when he was younger, I mean, he would get up for alley-oops.
Oh, yeah.
Drive the basket and dunk on guys. You know, it would look pretty ridiculous. I mean, now, of course, you could always say back then, you know, you couldn't carry the ball the way you can now. That's what, you know, my dad would say that. And he'd probably be right. You know, I mean, we can just like, the only kind of dribble you can do is just like straight up and down. You know, and maybe like a behind the back every once in a while, then that makes your life a lot harder to kind of drive to the basket and blow by guys. But especially considering how much they got out in transition in those days too, having someone who could just fly to the basket like that, even just sort of an average NBA shooting guard or small forward or point guard would really kill it. So I think that that's, you know, you would have to go back to maybe like the early 60s or something before Wilt came in. I don't think any average guy today would be anywhere near as good as Wilt, for sure.
Steven Trinkwald said, what logistics would a 30-team D-League need to coordinate to largely replace the NCAA for elite prospects trying to make the league? Do you mind if I answer this first?
Please.
So there are kind of two big ideas. One of them, of course, is the financial component of it. I mean, just because you can bring that and the other one can't. And also the age part of it. I think that you would need to be able to at least have kids that came out of high school. I would even seriously consider allowing kids even earlier than that, but that's just me being a revolutionary on this kind of an idea. So if you did those, then you could compete, but it is a very different world, and so you would have to, the money would have to be good enough for them to take the trade-off, and you also are in a complicated spot with those guys if you're still going to have a line of those players are ineligible to play in the NBA. So you'll still see some kids go to college. I don't think you're ever going to see it fully replace it, especially with the value of an education and a scholarship. But if you want the talent levels to be relatively equal or superior, I think that you have to work within those two frames first.
Yeah, the question was, what logistics would a 30-team D-League need? Let's start with billions of dollars, like college athletics has supporting it. And not only do you get exposure, you know, the college lifestyle is certainly much, much less miserable than traveling on buses and small planes and getting up at 6 a.m. in the D-League to go travel places. The facilities in college with all the money that they have are just a million times better. You know, you're actually at home. You can build a life for yourself. You're not like trying to find a girlfriend in, you know, North Dakota or something. I guess South Dakota. Not that there's anything wrong with women in South Dakota, but it's just, you know, harder in a small city than when you're just in college. I think most people would talk about that. So I think the lifestyle is always going to be worse in the D-League. And also, you know, we're probably being naive if we're not saying that some of these guys are getting hundreds of thousands of dollars under the table to go play at these universities as well. And you also just have the marketing that comes from having gone to a school and kind of being beloved there, ultimately, that profile. So I really think that unless you're going to be paying guys $1 million a year, I mean, that's sort of been what it's taken, right? The two guys who have gone into the professional ranks rather than college were Emmanuel Mudiay and Brandon Jennings, and both those guys were rumored to have some issues with qualifying academically. They might have wanted to do college anyway. And, you know, Mudiay got paid $1 million. Jennings got paid $1 million in China and in Rome. So I think that's really the amount of money that it would take. And to really pay guys that much, you know, you're going to need a big time infusion of cash. And I don't think you're ever really going to get that. Now, the one difference might be, you said the age limit. Maybe if they started letting guys in who are like 15 or 16, like European teams, then you might say, hey, I want to just go be a pro right now and just get the best coaching. I do think that probably the D-League even can do a better job of coaching necessarily than college can. And you are playing against better competition. But those extraneous factors, ultimately, I mean, there's just so much money in college that that system is always going to be entrenched. And unless you're actually on the big league team making a big league salary, players are always going
to
go to college.
Would you support, theoretically, if you were in charge of the D-League, would you support dropping the age down that low?
Maybe like 17, so that you could have a guy on your team for 2 years, and then, you know, he could get drafted. But again, when you have one-to-one affiliates, there's not a ton of incentive for these D-League teams to take guys on who are just going to go into the draft. Why develop someone when there's a 29 out of 30 chance he's going to end up on some other team?
Right. This is why I've said that it would be easier to make the second best league in the world a league that was not affiliated with the NBA, which I do think is possible.
By the way, I just wanted to mention this, since I don't know if I ever have in the program. For me, the way to solve the inequities of college, because they talk about paying players, right? So, yeah, it's definitely very unfair that in college football and college basketball, these sports bring in all this money and the players don't get any of it unless it's like under the table and you can get yourself in trouble, or, you know, it's an education that probably costs like 10 to 30 grand a year or something like that. That's not enough for what a lot of these guys are bringing in. However, you also have the problem that if you're going to pay guys in college basketball and college football, how are you going to determine what that's going to be? If you're a walk-on, do you get paid anything? There's going to be this stratification between, you know, just like there is in the NBA, where guys would make a lot of money when you're a true difference maker. And then if you're just like kind of a guy, you know, you don't really deserve to make money. You're not the actually providing the value of that money to the university. And then not to mention then the inequity of college basketball and football getting paid. And then in women's sports and, you know, the non-revenue producing men's sports, you're not really producing money for the university, and now the university has to pay you too. So I think that having the players be paid directly by the university probably doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I think that what you should be able to do, though, is you just take off any restriction of getting extra benefits. So if Jahlil Okafor wants to go do a commercial for a car dealership in Raleigh-Durham, or they want to just give him a car, or whatever you want to do, as long as the university isn't paying you, if you just have some booster who decides it's worth it to just, all right, hey, I'll give Jahlil Okafor $1 million, sign a contract, go to Duke, fine. You know, as long as the university isn't paying them directly, you just let the free market handle what these guys are worth outside of that. And yeah, definitely people would go to certain universities because they have better boosters, or they have higher profile, or they kind of have endorsements in that town. That would be better, but that's fine. Like, there's no real, whatever the negative externalities from that are, it doesn't eclipse the fact that these guys are making money and they're in a system where they're being prevented from actually realizing their true economic worth. So yeah, if you're going to be, oh no, like the boosters will be running the program, or, you know, Jim Bob's car dealership is going to now let Oklahoma pay too much money to these guys, and now Jim Bob's car dealership is going to have some influence in the program or something like that. Yeah, you know, that's probably not ideal, but compared to the inequity of just not being able to get paid for what your talent provides, it's pretty minor in my view.
The other big one is likeness rights. That I think that would be another way of resolving a lot of these inequities, and you could even, you know, with video games and things like that, you could actually do a lot with that too, and that would, you know, there would be some imbalances with that, but I'm totally cool with that. That's fine. You know, if they're going to, you know, if a guy who's an offensive lineman at Alabama would get paid double what somebody who was at Washington State would, that's fine. I have no opposition to that.
And it's rare that I'll get my hackles up like this, but this is one of those things that really kind of bothers me. And the reason that college players don't get paid is because the powers that be are selfish, whether it's fans who want to delude themselves into thinking that these guys are just playing for the love of the game and they're just playing hard and, you know, hey, they're just like me when I was a student, you know, and now I can, you know, derive all my worth as a 45-year-old man from what these 19-year-olds are doing. Or whether it's the coaches who would much rather get all the endorsements for themselves, even though they wouldn't say that, but that's true. I mean, these coaches get paid more because they don't have to pay the players anything. Whether it's the university just pocketing a ton of money. And all of those interests, just to me, are so much smaller than someone who a lot of times is coming from a position where they don't have a ton of money, where even 1 year of getting paid what they're worth in college with the amount of money they're bringing in could be a life changer for them or their family. Even when, you know, I mean, think of all the guys who just you know, never really made it in the NBA or professional basketball, but were really integral players on a college team that was fantastic. Those guys could have a lot of money right now. They brought in a ton of money for their school, and yet now they don't, you know. So that's really like whatever things that you think as a fan about, you know, what's right and what's wrong about college, that is so small of a difference compared to actually like young men who wouldn't have a chance otherwise, like making millions of dollars. I think it's ridiculous that you're just not letting guys at least somehow get their true economic worth, even if they're not being paid directly by the university.
Yeah, agreed on all those counts. And it's just a hard situation for me also, because when you have the situation where there's so much money involved and there's so much profit being gained, and you see a group that is not being utilized, it is a guarantee that it's going to go below the table, because there's too much of an incentive not to do it. So you're creating this circumstance where it's all going like that. And the other part that makes me super uncomfortable about it with college is that when those things get exposed, which is somewhat rare compared to how much it happens, it is future players that are hurt by that, not present players, not really the coaches for the most part, because oftentimes they're gone by then. And so you have this situation where the punishments may fit the crimes to a loose degree, but those who are facing the punishments are completely different.
And how much money are they wasting on enforcement at this point, right? Like, that's another, I mean, when you consider how much all these compliance officers are getting paid at universities and how much these ridiculous investigations with tons of lawyers tracking down receipts to figure out whether someone got paid or not. How about we just let the players get that money instead of just spending all this money to make sure that they don't get paid? You know, I mean, there's just no other place in life where there's this feeling that like making your money as a capitalist is bad. It's like what our whole society is built on, and yet there are these artificial, ridiculous constructs that prevent that from happening in college basketball. All right, that's way too long on that. We're probably going to have to take this to a part two after another couple of questions or so. It is my turn here. Hussein Muhammad, which recent NBA team of the past 5 or 10 years would match up best with these Warriors in a playoff series?
The best Miami Heat team. And I think the best Miami Heat team would actually stand a decent shot against them, because their defensive ability was there and their offense in transition. Like, if this Warriors team turned the ball over like they do sometimes, they would be the flying death machine that they were. And I think they would do a pretty good job on them.
It's interesting. I agree with you on that Heat team, the 2012-13 Heat, when you could bring out LeBron, Wade, before he really got hurt on the end of that year. I mean, that's what people forget, is that he was actually really good that year before he kind of was a shell of himself in the playoffs. You know, Chris Bosh obviously is a great big man who could also switch, you know, about as well as most big men could onto someone like Steph Curry down the end of the game. You know, Ray Allen, a wonderful shooter, though probably someone that they could attack defensively a little bit. But I think the biggest thing that made me think of them was because the way they played pick and rolls, they blitz pick and rolls the way basically you have to do against the Warriors. That was their default defense. And they had, with Wade and LeBron and even a guy like Mario Chalmers, the ability to move around and get back to guys. Since that's their default defense, it wouldn't be as difficult for them to make the transition to guarding Steph in that way.
And they were a team that was open to trying unconventional lineups, and that's what you would have to do against the Warriors. I mean, they probably play Bosh at the five most of the time.
Let's think about some of these other teams. I think 08 Boston would be another one that kind of comes to mind a little bit, just due to KG's defensive ability. If you wanted to play KG at center, I think that you could match up pretty well. He's another guy who could switch pretty well before he got injured. And then I don't know if they would beat the Warriors. They probably wouldn't, because their defense wouldn't be as good. But probably the one series that I would most want to see, when you say match up best, this is more for my own entertainment than for actually beating them, the 04-05 Phoenix Suns, which was my favorite iteration of that team.
That would be a lot of fun. What do you think about the Spurs' most recent title team versus this Warriors team?
Oh, that 2014?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a tough call. I don't think, though, I think that the Warriors switching, I mean, that team was so good because they moved the ball so well, and they had, I think teams are kind of actually over, or teams, like pundits are kind of overrating their finals performance, which was unbelievable, right? I mean, and at the time, it was just absolutely shocking to see a team with LeBron. I mean, I think probably most people thought that maybe the Spurs were only a slight favorite in that series. For them to just murder that LeBron Heat like that was crazy. But, you know, in retrospect, really, that team wasn't that good. You see what LeBron's done in Cleveland. It seems like he was kind of, you know, moving down to the end of his career. Wade was pretty decrepit at that point. They had Bosh, who was pretty good, but really no one else on that team. I mean, like half that team retired basically right after that. And I think that the Warriors switching could still cause that team problems. I think that they would be about as well equipped as any team in recent vintage to stop the Spurs, whereas the way that Miami was playing defense, they just didn't have the personnel for that kind of blitzing anymore, and the Spurs just carved them up. So I think that team would be really good, but I don't think that they would do as well against the Warriors. And I think ultimately, Steph being such a good scorer, I mean, you got to remember that Kawhi Leonard at that time was not the Kawhi Leonard that he is now as an individual scorer.
Right,
that
was just going to say that.
I think that the Warriors could take him.
It's outside the time frame, but I've also thought about the Shaq Kobe Lakers, and I think they would struggle a lot with the specific strengths of this Warriors team.
Yeah, I think so. I think the Warriors could double Shaq pretty well, and I think that Shaq just... he would look like Hassan Whiteside did last night. He just couldn't get out on the pick and roll. And if the Warriors really chose to attack it in a seven-game series, you could just run a pick and roll with whoever Shaq was guarding and Steph and just get a wide-open three every time.
And they didn't have the depth of talent to really exploit the way that you would do that. Like, just really top to bottom on those teams. They were really top-heavy. And I think this Warriors team is, unless your top-heavy guys are transcendent in a way that gives the Warriors problems, like I think Durant is kind of like this, I don't think that the Warriors would struggle too much.
All right, let's do like two more here, and then we'll bring it to part two. I think it's your turn.
Yuxing Chen, is Jordan Clarkson actually good? We'll just leave it there. He has more to the question, but I think that's all we need.
He's currently number 50 in RPM among point guards. Part of that is just because he's playing on a really bad Lakers team. A lot of that is his defense. His defense grades out really terribly by on-off metrics, as I'm sure it does for just about everyone on the Lakers. But he does have talent. He's older than you kind of think he is. I think he's 23, might even turn 24 next year. That's usually what happens when you're 23 this year, I guess. And he's shooting 38% on threes. That's probably the biggest reason for optimism. Did not have a reputation as a great shooter coming out of college. Didn't shoot that percentage. He's not shooting enough to where you can really be comfortable that he is a 38% three-point shooter. And he's shooting like three a game or something, so his volume is not huge. But if that's real, if he can get into even well above 35%, he can get that shot off with his size against a lot of point guards. And he's got some pretty good athleticism. He's got a nice mid-range jumper. His passing is down a little bit this year, but that's because he's playing with Kobe and Lou Williams and D'Angelo Russell, all whom had the ball in their hands a ton. I think he's someone that you can look at, has a ceiling of being an average point guard in the league. And when you consider that when he gets maxed out, if another team maxed him out, he's basically going to make the mid-level exception for the first 2 years. And then he's going to make, a little over, 22, 23 million the next 2 years. That averages out to like 15 million or so. And then also that artificially low salary in the first 2 years, which they only get if another team signs the offer sheet. If the Lakers sign him to something, that doesn't happen. But if another team signs him to the offer sheet, then they can really help them get into the free agent market in 2017 in a way that if they just re-signed into a contract, it wouldn't. So I would, if I'm the Lakers, I'm rooting for another team to give him a max offer sheet under the Arenas rule because he's a restricted free agent with two or less a year of experience. And then I would very happily match that.
He will turn 24 in June, so he will play all of next year at 24. My big concern with him is that I don't feel much confidence that he can run an NBA offense. And there are guys who can defend point guards who don't do that, but you have to play with some very specific guys next to you. That, to me, makes him more of a third guard, which is a very valuable thing in this league, and I think that he can do enough against second units. And I think he can slide defensively between the two guard positions. I wouldn't want to play him with a smaller guy, Mike Conley or smaller, I think would be a little bit of a concern. But his contract value is artificially lowered by the Arenas provision. And one thing that's a nice little benefit for him is he's going to hit his next contract at probably 27, 28, which is very positive for him just in terms of, if hopefully he'll have himself marketed at that point. Also, assuming that he signs using the Arenas provision, he will be coming off a really high salary. So for some teams, the concept of anchoring actually does matter. A guy coming off that team thought he was worth it, and so you could see that. But for me, as a basketball player, I see him more as a third guard, but he can prove me wrong. Guys do that all the time.
Alex Dulanovich, who do you think is the worst matchup for Toronto in the first round? Chicago, Atlanta, Charlotte, Detroit, or Washington?
I'm going to say Chicago quickly just because they're the best team if they're healthy. But beyond them, for me, I'd actually go with Charlotte. And the reason for that is that they have a guy in Nick Batum that I think Atlanta would just struggle with. He's a little bit bigger than their perimeter defensive guys.
Toronto would struggle with.
Toronto would struggle with. Yeah, right, sorry. That Toronto would struggle with. They don't...
Are we assuming that Carroll has come back now?
Yeah, well, I'm kind of treating that as an indefinite but likely proposition.
Yeah.
I think that's probably the most fair way to do it.
Yeah, I mean, he may not be 100%, but I think you can at least count on him to just kind of shoot some threes, maybe not hit him as great of a percentage if his legs aren't there, and, you know, at least defend okay.
Yeah.
And when you talk about Chicago being healthy, obviously we're assuming that Noah is out, but that everyone
else is. Butler, most importantly, is back. And so if you're going with Toronto, then would think about Charlotte. I think they have defensive talent, and their shooting on the perimeter from their forward spots is something that I think could be a challenge for Toronto, just because it's a little bit hard to deal with. And Kaminsky actually did a relatively nice job yesterday against Cleveland. I think he has to play in that series. He would have to play the five, but I could see Jonas having a little bit of trouble with him.
Yeah, I do think that Biombo would be someone who it would be interesting to see whether he and Valanciunas would be able to stay on the court all that well against the spacing that Charlotte provides, and whether Charlotte's going to go with Al Jefferson or not, too. I think that kind of gives those guys more of a hiding place, as opposed to when you're playing Hawes and Kaminsky, you got to get out to the three-point line and guard those guys. I mean, I think Charlotte has played the best out of any of those teams this year. I think Detroit probably just doesn't have the offensive firepower, although they could maybe cause some problems, especially if Carroll is not back for that old Raptors bugaboo of being able to stop guys on the wing. But Jimmy Butler, assuming he is healthy, I think he is the best guy on any of those teams to guard DeMar DeRozan. I think that he can really cause problems for DeRozan. And then Toronto, unless Carroll is back, has absolutely nobody to guard Butler either, as we saw when Butler put up 40 on them in the second half. Toronto also doesn't have a ton of great rim protection unless they're playing Biombo. So that's something that Derrick Rose really struggles to finish against good defenders inside. But if he's going against Luis Scola, who, bless his heart, tries to make the most of his abilities, but is not a great rim protector even so, and Valanciunas, I think that Rose could really make some hay against that defense also. So, I would say probably Chicago, even though without Noah, I think Chicago's defense is probably going to get roasted by Toronto.
Yeah, I think that's about right.
All right, let's do one more, and then we'll take it to a part two. What is your view on the rotation of star players on a team? In general, if a team has two star players, should they look to maximize the minutes played by both together or minimize the minutes played by neither or do something in between? That is from George Hett.
There are two key considerations, and I think you can't really talk about this without going into both. And one is how well their games fit together. And then the second one is the surrounding talent. So with Oklahoma City, I don't think their Russell Westbrook and Durant, I don't think their games mesh together perfectly. And they don't have a ton of guys that can generate particularly offense outside of those two. So in those circumstances, you want to separate them. However, I wrote a piece this week for Warriors World advocating that the Warriors should I think they should put their stars together more because I think it amplifies all of their games. And I also think that it sometimes leads to some situations where they poorly use the other guys and it would force some things. So it really does depend on circumstance. And I think that the idea of the fit between those two stars is actually the most important of those and can somewhat be lost in the shuffle sometimes.
Yeah, Phoenix used to play Amari Stoudemire and Steve Nash together for the majority of their minutes. And that makes a ton of sense. You have Steve Nash is a great pick-and-roll point guard. Amari Stoudemire is a great pick-and-roll finisher, right? Although Amari could score one-on-one on his own, too. But they kind of had some other places that they could go, especially in the later years, to get offense with the second unit. I agree with you on Russ and KD. And really, a lot of it's about the supporting cast, right? Like, if you've got someone like Lou Williams coming onto your second unit, then maybe you can get away with not playing KD, one of KD or Russ all the time, because then you have a lineup that can make sense, a way to score. I think for me, what I always think about with bench units is, what can you hang your hat on offensively? Do you have something you can go to where you can say, all right, this is going to get us a bucket somehow? And if you don't have that, then you damn well better leave one of your stars out there at all times. Oklahoma City does not have that. And actually, Donovan, for the first time, staggered KD and Russ for the entire game against the Mavericks, and it worked out pretty well. But, yeah, I mean, if you've got Cam Payne and Randy Foy and Deion Waiters and Enes Kanter, who's more of a dependent player offensively, if that's your second unit, yeah, you're going to struggle to score. And even if your second unit is just so good defensively, like, all right, we're just going to play to a scoreless tie, you know, the way the Bulls used to do back when Derrick Rose would go out of the game on some of their great teams in the early part of this decade, then yeah, all right, that's still something. That's something that you can look at that, all right, this unit is going to be really good. We can compete for these 4 minutes where we have both of the stars off the floor. If you don't have that, then yeah, you damn well better stack. All right, that'll do it for today because someone decided that he was going to go on a long rant about society's evils in college basketball. We did not get through all these, but we have a bunch more great questions coming up for part two, which we will probably release at some point over the weekend, maybe on Sunday. We'll talk to you all next time.